Hello and welcome to the next episode of the Kurdistan Connection with myself, Matthew Broomfield. As listeners will be aware, on this show we try and look into the connections between what's happening in Kurdistan, in Turkey and in the wider Middle East and broader global political issues, questions and movements. And so today I'm very glad to welcome our next guest, Eric Edman from DiEM25. And I think, good morning, Eric. How are you?
Hi, good morning, Matt. Thank you very much for having me. Good morning to our listeners.
Thank you. And I think Eric will be a great guest kind of in his own right. Eric represents a pan-European coalition. DiEM25 works as its political director and coordinates political strategy for that movement. As listeners will be aware, the Kurdish issue has become a key issue in kind of broader questions about the political role and alignment of European nations as we move forward. So I'm sure Eric has a lot to say about that in general as well. And we're particularly happy to welcome Eric as our guest today because Eric has just returned from a political delegation observing particularly conditions in prisons in Turkey and meeting the parliamentary opposition there. So Eric, welcome back to Europe. Hope you're doing well.
Thank you very much. Yeah, thank you for the invitation. I'm fine. After the things that we heard during our visit in Turkey, I must say that it's almost a bit of a relief to be out of there, especially the way our mission there was presented was not at all welcoming, especially by the pro-government media. We were presented as people who are there to negotiate with terrorists and the rest of it. So it was very clear quite quickly that the work that we were there to do was absolutely not welcome by pro-government media especially. So even though Europe is in no way ideal, and as we will talk about later, is absolutely not innocent in this whole story, it is a bit of a relief to be back.
Absolutely. So yeah, maybe you could just begin, kind of as you have already, just yeah, kind of say what was the purpose of this visit? Was this your first time yourself visiting Turkey, and who else accompanied you on the trip?
I've been to Turkey a couple of times, both for pleasure and for work. This time our delegation was split into three. One was in Ankara, one was in Ahmet, and one was in Istanbul, and I was in the Istanbul delegation. We spent 5 days in Turkey, all of us. There were about 12 of us per group, so a total of 36 people from different countries, not just from Europe, but around the world. We had people from South Africa, people from other Middle Eastern countries, and so on. And we met with a variety of actors surrounding primarily Mr. Abdullah Öcalan's case, but in general, the cases of political prisoners and prisoners in general in Turkey. We met with members of Mr. Öcalan's legal team. We met with legal associations, bar associations, civil society actors. And as you said in your introduction, we also met with representatives of political parties of the opposition in Turkey in order to essentially conduct a fact-finding mission and create a general overview of the situation. First of all, around Mr. Öcalan's imprisonment, but as quickly became obvious, Mr. Öcalan's imprisonment is essentially ground zero for the kind of human rights violations that are being experienced by political prisoners in various prisons in Turkey. So in many ways, İmralı prison is a kind of inhumane laboratory, if you like, where these things are first implemented and then exported to other prisons and other prisoners around the country. So very quickly, the mission became about much more than Mr. Öcalan, but the general state of human rights in Turkey.
And so, yeah, what kind of did you learn? Maybe you can summarize about, I guess, beyond the isolation of Abdullah Öcalan, general conditions for political prisoners in Turkey. What were your main kind of takeaways about that aspect of the rule of law in Turkey?
So one of the things that became clear was that everything starts as an emergency measure. And Imrali prison is the first place that those emergency measures are being implemented because of security reasons. Usually that's how it's being presented by the regime. So essentially Mr. Öcalan and the other prisoners, but primarily Mr. Öcalan in Imrali, has not been allowed to be in touch with his legal team, with his family, and indeed with anybody else, including external doctors, for the past 21, 22 months, almost 2 years. Essentially, people don't know if he's alive or not, to put it bluntly. This is a clear violation of his human rights. He allegedly is allowed 1 hour of social time per week, which again is a severe violation of his human rights. But even that, there is no way of confirming it because nobody's being allowed to access Mr. Öcalan. In the beginning, this was done under the pretext of bad weather conditions that didn't allow ferries to cross. There were different excuses by the regime, but eventually the issue was securitized, especially after the coup attempt. Since then, there's been a very coherent degrading of the conditions of the prisoners in Imrali. And what civil society actors and lawyers told us was that this is becoming more and more the norm in various prisons around the country, especially for political prisoners. The groups that are most affected are the Kurdish people, but also women, LGBTQ plus people, various minorities essentially in the country. And all of it is being done under the pretext of securitization. So at the very heart of this issue is this idea that the connection of the Kurdish struggle for justice with a security concern for the Turkish state. And under that pretext, especially in the lead up to the elections now in May, Mr. Erdogan has been using it as a rhetorical point and a political foundation in order to stir up concern in society. So what we agreed on as a concern in society and therefore reinforce this idea of a need for a strong leader and the rest of it is the standard recipe for most authoritarian leaders, of which Mr. Erdogan is absolutely one. Now, what we agreed as a delegation is that this, of course, is a legal matter, but its resolution is not a legal matter because the Turkish state knows that it's acting illegally. Europe knows that what is going on is illegal. What is blocking the resolution of this matter, both in the case of Mr. Öcalan, but all political prisoners in Turkey, including lawyers who are being imprisoned everywhere because they defend political prisoners, because they've defended Mr. Öcalan. We found out that every single lawyer that Mr. Öcalan has had has been imprisoned. And the current lawyers are also under investigation and told us they are most likely to be imprisoned themselves in the near future as well. So when the legal profession doesn't feel in a place to conduct its job in freedom, then it's very clear that the matter is political. So the resolution of Mr. Öcalan's case and the general issue of political prisoners in Turkey and the conditions under which they are being held is one that would only be resolved through a political solution, not through legal means, because the law is very clear. It is very clear that what is going on is illegal. The problem, therefore, is not the law. It is that even this stripped down version of the Turkish constitution, which has been suffering in the last 5, 10, 20 years in Turkey, even under this particular constitution and this legal structure, what is happening to these prisoners is illegal. So the problem is not the law. The problem is that the law is not being enforced. And that is entirely a political matter.
Yeah. So I think some observers I know have just kind of described what's been happening in Turkey, particularly since the coup attempt in 2016, as a kind of coup by degrees, in that Erdogan has been slowly seizing power and kind of step by step by step imprisoning the opposition in a way that if he did it overnight, there would maybe be a stronger pushback against, but he's kind of been able to very slowly, steadily, securely consolidate his power. Kind of with that in mind, was there a sense among the delegation or among people you met that the elections this year will be a kind of turning point, or do you think this process of authorization and securitization is just going to continue in the years ahead?
It will only depend to the extent that this argument of securitization will be convincing to the Turkish voters. The greatest allies that the Kurdish people have, I myself am half Greek, so I'm also very involved with what's going on in the region, and this growing securitization of Turkish society is something that also affects my country and my country's relations with Turkey, of course. The real allies that the Kurds, the Greeks, the general neighborhood around Turkey have are not NATO, it's not the French, it's not the United States. It is the Democrats, the civil society actors in Turkey who are fighting against this militarization and this de-democratization of Turkish society. That's something that's become abundantly clear to us. The real hope we have here are not so much these external actors who to a large extent have been contributing to this situation and have been the best case scenario been passively ignoring it, and worst case scenario, been enabling it by empowering Mr. Erdogan's regime. And we can go into more detail about that in a moment, about the role that the international community has played in allowing Mr. Erdogan to get to where he is. But really, the great hope that we have is in the strengthening of the Turkish opposition and those who are brave enough to speak out about what is going on in these prisons and the conditions that people are in, and the general state of democracy in the country and people's freedom to speak their mind. And it is there that we're depositing most of our hope, and that is the work that we will try and contribute towards in the next month on the lead up to the elections.
And so as you would see it, kind of the role of this delegation and the work more broadly of democratic movements in Europe is to create pressure for the democratic opposition in Turkey in its various forms to make its voice heard. How can that be achieved? What kind of positive concrete steps can be taken towards that end?
So it's important not to be delusional about what can work and what cannot. So, as I said, the status quo right now is largely the result of European and NATO foreign policy. And, you know, the institutions such as the Council of Europe, the CPT, the of the Council of Europe, the European Commission, they are all bodies that are not willing to really up the pressure against Erdogan's regime because of their own geopolitical interests in the region. And primarily, I would say that because often Europe likes to present itself as this champion of human rights in the world, it takes great pride in this, but you know, at the same breath will then sign treaties such as the one with Turkey and Mr. Erdogan for the inhumane captivity of refugees at the Turkish border, because they are so terrified of the rise of the far right in Europe. So they're willing to really sacrifice these ideals and these principles and to empower Mr. Erdogan with astronomical amounts of money and an essential bribing to enable the creation of these essentially refugee prisons, which then further allow Erdogan to present himself as this kind of strongman who can really get what he wants. You can see it also in the way that he's been dealing with Sweden and Finland and their bid to join NATO. It's playing right into the hands of Erdogan's narrative and allows him to continue presenting himself as this sort of powerful leader to his people who defends Turkish interests from foreign interference. So going with these demands to institutions such as the European Union, such as the Council of Europe, is something that is important because it needs to be done to keep the pressure up and make sure that we stand for what is right. But we also need to be realistic about the chances of something like that ever being successful, because there are bigger geopolitical interests at play here, and those are the ones that need to be attacked. So really, the area in which we hope as a movement, as the M25, and with the Progressive International that we're also a member of, to really focus on is in order to really try and influence public opinion on the matter. the securitization of the Kurdish people is not something that's only affected Turkish society and the Turkish people. It's something that also has roots in the rest of Europe. The PKK is still listed as a terrorist organization in many European countries. The Kurds are often sort of stigmatized as a terrorist population, a little bit as has been the case with the Palestinian cause and the Palestinian people. There's a lot of work to be done in that area and to de-link these things in the minds of Europeans, who then can translate that delinking into a different kind of political support for parties which do exist in Europe, that are willing to take a harsher stance towards Mr. Erdogan and the kind of violations that he's conducting. And it's that kind of change that can, not in the short term, but in the long term, really start producing results for the Kurdish issue, instead of basically barking up the wrong tree, which is this strategy of using these kind of institutions that are in the hands of far more conservative interests.
Indeed. And do you think there's kind of, as you mentioned, the kind of broad European stance on these issues is, well, these are unfortunate human rights issues, but particularly in the past year, we've seen more than ever with the NATO accession crisis, the stance that, you know, nothing is kind of more important now to European states than their security interests. And Erdogan, whether you like him or not, forms a part of that. Are there pragmatic arguments that you think can or should be put to these European institutions and to those who currently hold power in Europe as to why Erdogan's actions should be curtailed? Or do you think the priority should be more building from the grassroots, as you said, a kind of change in approach to the Kurdish movement?
Yeah, I think this is both fronts are incredibly important. And in Europe, we are fighting against our own kind of militarization of society, against, in this case, Russia, and this polarization of society into two camps, if you like. You can either be pro-NATO or you can be pro-Putin, and there's nothing in between. And then this idea that one needs to choose a type of imperialism to support. And, you know, if Russia is the bigger threat to Europe, then that means we need to support American imperialism. And then vice versa, when Russia is not felt to be as much of a threat, then we kind of rally to the other side. And it really shows Europe's weakness. It shows that the weakness that the European Union has chronically had, not to be able to establish a third pole, a sort of non-aligned position where that can support these kinds of principles and values that we go on about so often as in Europe and are so proud of. But really, when it comes to it, we become enslaved to these kind of external interests. This is a bigger play. You see it in the case of the invasion of the Ukraine, that this is a conversation, although it's a situation that's happening in Europe. It's a situation that's being handled between Washington and Moscow. The European Union, the European states do not have as big a role to play in these geopolitical developments. And if we're going to be a voice for justice, for good, in these matters, then Europe first needs to establish itself as an independent political actor. Right now, it is essentially an annex to NATO. It's an agent of the geopolitics of NATO, unfortunately. And the addition of Sweden and Finland to that alliance is further proof of that. So before we can really talk about Europe's role, Europe needs to develop the ability to stand by its principles and by its decisions. And then we can discuss what those decisions and those opinions need to be. Right now, we're simply peddling to bigger interests that are not even based in the European Union.
Indeed. And so to stand that on its head a little bit, as you've said, Turkey undeniably does occupy this very geostrategic position, and, you know, politically as well, has made itself increasingly relevant in the polarization between Moscow and Washington. What role can or could or should Turkey play in a reformed Europe that you're working towards? Because does Turkey also have a place in this community? And what might that look like? What should we be hoping for in Turkey?
I think the very definition of a community is non-exclusive. Everybody should have a place in a community. And this idea of, you know, is Turkey in Europe is neither here nor there. Turkey is where it is. Whether that is Europe or not, it's still in Europe's neighborhood, you know, whether it's within it or without it. And really defining Europe as a geographic location, I don't think is particularly useful if the European project is going to be one of peace and cooperation as it was meant to be in its inception. So we should be talking less about whether Turkey has a role to play and instead talk about what role should Turkey play. And this kind of reform needs to happen, as we've already said, in Europe. And Europe has a big part to play in its own position, and ideology needs to be rethought. And that can only happen if it comes from people and the political will being created in Europe for that, a less conservative one. And then, of course, Turkey itself needs to abandon this militarized extremist path that Mr. Erdogan has put it on and return towards the rule of law, democratic society with, you know, justice for everybody's interests, regardless of whether they are a minority or not. And then within this context, what really needs to happen is a new dialogue needs to be opened, first of all, at the regional level. In the southeastern Mediterranean, which is a region fraught with conflict, not least because of Turkey, but also my own country has not been playing a peaceful role in the whole story. It tries in its own ways to maneuver itself. And I think everybody has been forced to a certain extent to play this game, instead of coming around the negotiating table, because it's so difficult to negotiate with a regime like the one that Erdogan's been developing in the last few years. So a reformed Turkey and a Europe that's also found this more inclusive path, the first thing that we would like to see is a regional conference of the southeastern Mediterranean, where all parties that are involved in the region can come around the negotiating table and resolve in common the kind of issues that we've been facing. Instead of that, you see that the strategy that Mr. Erdogan has been pursuing is one of bilateral talks, where he can really use the political power he has as leverage to essentially bully his neighbors into various positions, with the support behind closed doors of other political actors such as the United States, who can act as, or Germany indeed, and France to a certain extent, who act as referees, and through that role of referee pursue their own interests. That is something that is far harder to do in a regional conference, where all these nations are represented and can come in a spirit of togetherness and of regional community to resolve their differences. So that's something that we would really like to see, a move away from these bilateral talks, which is the kind of breeding ground of further conflict, because it's essentially an arm wrestle between different political interests, and a move towards this more regional approach, where everybody can have a say. And then, you know, off of that, when we've kind of solved or laid the foundation for change in the region, in the southeastern Mediterranean region, we need to always keep the door open for further conversations about Turkey's role in Europe. The way that Turkey's bid to join the European Union has kind of been put on ice is very inducive to a sense of not exactly a Cold War, but the way it's been left is sort of a breeding ground for conflict. So it needs to be reopened, rediscussed, renegotiated with the inclusion of a variety of actors, and properly resolved with an open mind to either resolution. And regardless of whether or not Turkey becomes a member of the European Union at any point, that doesn't mean it's going anywhere. The country will never leave. It's the same silly thinking that got us in trouble with Brexit. The fact that the United Kingdom left the European Union doesn't mean that it left Europe. So this idea that you're with us or with you're not or you're against us is the kind of thinking that some politicians have tried to enact in the case of Turkey. And I think it's incredibly dangerous and really not inducive to a harmonious coexistence in the European region. And we need to be moving away from that.
Absolutely. Oh, thank you very much, Eric, for sharing both your observations and then, yeah, a few kind of sensible policy proposals arising from that. We are kind of running out of time now. I would like to talk about these issues more. I don't know if, just to finish, you have briefly kind of any other observations from the conversations you had in Turkey, perhaps looking ahead to the elections, what was kind of the mood there? How do people feel? And what are they kind of looking for?
All I can say is our hearts and our minds go out to the heroes of this story, which are the people on the ground in Turkey who are risking their lives, their livelihoods in this struggle for higher causes of justice, of democracy, of human rights. And we will be doing everything we can from afar to strengthen their efforts on the ground, and also to make sure that on our side, we're not, through our countries, through the institutions that our nations are a part of, we're not making their lives even harder by enabling the sort of policies that Mr. Erdogan has been pursuing in the last few years. It's a long, hard fight. But what was really heartening to see was that we are all more or less on the same page. After all these years, we can see what works and what doesn't. So there was a broad agreement about the way forward, and I'm very much looking forward to the next few months. We will do the best we can to have a positive result for progressives in Turkey, and to hopefully open the way slowly to a new kind of situation for the southeastern Mediterranean.
Yes. Yeah. Thank you very much, Eric. Thank you for going on the delegation. It's very important to have people there seeing what's going on and bearing witness and coming back to talk about it and share ideas and proposals here in Europe as well.
It was an honor and a pleasure.
Yes. And we hope to speak to you again sometime about these issues. Thank you also to our listeners for joining us here on the Kurdistan Connection. I've been Matthew Broomfield. Until the next time, goodbye.